but his newest book is called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. Corman, along with writer Jim Jerome, reveals his 40 years of success as America's preeminent independent filmmaker. The book is published by Random House, and Rogers' films include, but are not limited to, The Little Shop of Horrors, The Attack of the Crab Monsters, Viking Women, and The Beast with a Million Eyes. Roger claims that much of his success is due to the fact that he finances most of his own films and owns them outright. Filmmaker Roger Corman on the radio show for Monday night. Roger Corman here. He was on the television show, The Tomorrow Show, I believe, once. He's been here two or three times. Good talker. Great voice. If this man ever wants his own radio show, he can have it at the drop of a microphone. Very good talker. Who I feel as if I know because I've interviewed him on a number of occasions, and he always is good copy. Roger, thanks for coming in tonight.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Tom.
You know, they talk about Francis Ford Coppola and Steven Spielberg and others as graduates of the USC Film School. What's your alma mater?
I went to Stanford, but I have a degree in engineering.
Just in case, huh?
Right. You always have something to fall back.
When you go, and I've heard you on other programs talking about the first movie you made, the budget was $18,000. And I know that you have a Frankenstein picture that it's about to be released, or just...
Frankenstein Unbound comes out in the fall.
And that's a $9 million picture, which for you must have been just an absolute awash in money.
We were swimming in luxury.
When you go to... I'm sure you go to see the Batmans, don't you?
And, yes, I did.
And you see pictures that cost $60 million and $65 million. What do you think when you watch those movies?
Well... For one thing, I can't really tell what the budget is. If you say, here's a picture that costs $1 million and here's another picture that costs $2 million, you can see a real difference, assuming they're made by competent producers, between the $1 million and the $2 million picture.
Mm-hmm.
You see another picture and they say, this one costs $30 million and this one costs $60 million. There's very often no particular difference in
the
films.
Right. Because they both have access to all the special effects and anything else that they want.
Yes.
But when you go to a Batman, or you go to a Dick Tracy, and I'm trying to think of some other big-budget pictures, but I'm really not that current in the movies. But when you go to Die Hard 2, for example.
Total Recall.
Do you go to them, and do you walk away saying, gee, I could have done that for less, or I wouldn't have... Are you critical of other product and other directors just to yourself?
A little bit. When I see obvious waste, I just think, what were they doing? On the other hand, I remember when I saw George Lucas's first big science fiction picture, Star Wars, and I've forgotten what the budget was, but it was a big budget.
Mm-hmm.
But I came away thinking, he spent the whole thing correctly. That budget... is reflected by the film. It really was a big film.
What about Roger Corman? Wouldn't you like to make one big one, pal?
Well,
you know,
probably.
I mean, you know how to do it. I mean, you don't have to make vampire pictures and stuff like that. I'm sure that if you wanted to, you could make it a big budget extravaganza and make a wonderful film.
Well, I probably could, or I would hope that I could. The problem is, I have my own company. I work primarily for my own company. It's self-financed, so it's kind of a unit that over a period of time has built up, and there may be a certain feeling, well, it's going pretty well. Maybe I shouldn't break this winning streak. On the other hand, maybe you should break a winning streak and... order to do something
like I'm already flying blind, but have any of the majors ever come to you and said, you know, Roger, would you loan yourself out to us for just one picture?
Yes, a couple of times, and I have made a couple of pictures for major studios, but each time, I remember one time Columbia came to me when I was working on a picture for AIP in England, and they said, this is your chance to make big pictures. Sign with us, kid, and you'll make a
we'll make
big
a star,
picture.
Right.
And I went there. I signed the contract, came back from London. I actually took a slight cut in salary to sign the contract because I thought this is my chance to do big pictures. And immediately they started giving me little pictures. And I eventually, we tore up the contract and I left the studio.
Mm-hmm. But I was wondering today, as I heard you on one of the radio stations here in town, I thought, you know, I wonder if Roger has ever wanted, as part of a busman's holiday, to make a real big one, make a big blockbuster with a cast of thousands, you know, an epic picture that people will say, boy, this is the biggest thing that ever hit the screen.
Well, I took a halfway step there with Frankenstein Unbound. We had a cast that one day we had 200 extras on one day, which is starting to move slowly in that direction.
And when does Frankenstein Unbound appear? Fall?
It'll come out in the fall. I'm not certain the exact date yet.
What was it that attracted you to movies instead of engineering?
I think maybe the fact that I grew up in Southern California. I started off to be an engineer because my father was an engineer, and I thought I'd follow in my father's footsteps. And I was a senior in college when I really realized I didn't want to be an engineer, but it was easier to get the degree rather than start over in another major. And then I worked 4 days as an engineer, and I quit on the Thursday. I was clearly wrong.
Friday started making moving pictures.
Right.
We are talking with Roger Corman. His book is called How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. We are back with Roger Corman, who, along with Jim Jerome, has written How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime, a title which I'm sure was a big hit with the publisher, right?
Well, it was a giant hit with the publisher, but it's not necessarily true.
I know, because you've made more than 100.
And I lost a couple of times. But they liked the title, so I figured, okay.
Are you a member of the National Academy of Motion Picture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes.
The Oscars?
Right.
And do you vote for the Oscars?
Yes.
And what categories do you get to vote in? And I'll tell you where I'm going with this is, I know the guy gave a tremendous performance in My Left Foot, but when I look at the body of work of Morgan Freeman over the last year, not only was he superb in Driving Miss Daisy, but he did Lean on Me just about a year ago, the story of Joe Clark, the principal back in Jersey.
Yes.
And he played a major part in Glory with Denzel Washington, which was a tremendous motion picture. And I really think this guy got robbed this year. So I was just wondering if you voted for any of the Best Actor nominees.
Actually, I voted for Morgan Freeman. And I think the problem is this. You have a body of work that goes over a certain period of time, but the award is for one picture only. So somebody who does a spectacular performance, as the performance in My Left Foot was, leaps up and wins, and the body of work surrounding it, it isn't really factored into the equation.
Which means that Morgan Freeman will probably get the Oscar next year. And no matter what he does.
Right, that's happened, as we were talking earlier, that happens so often. You do a great job one year and you don't win, and there's kind of a sympathy vote for it, and you can win the next year, and it's happened with a performance that really isn't the best.
Mm-hmm. Incidentally, you've watched all this brouhaha involving the National Endowment for the Arts.
Yes.
And the right of filmmakers and sculptors and photographers and whomsoever to say what they want, unfettered by censorship from the government or anybody else. Where are you in all of this? What's going on here?
All right, I would take a kind of a middle-of-the-road approach. I am firmly opposed to censorship, and I believe any artist or any person has total freedom of speech and of expression, that there should be no censorship whatsoever unless you get into libel laws and things like that. On the other hand, the government or the mainstream establishment which gives subsidies or endowments is not necessarily incorrect when they say we want to steer our endowments in certain areas. So, and I'm kind of groping for this and thinking as I go along.
I know, because it's a tough one, Roger. Let me tell you. You know, I'll tell you funny stuff. Charlton Heston was here, about 2 weeks ago, talking about this thing. And where I think the National Endowment has made a tremendous mistake is in allowing its critics to focus attention on the negatives without talking about the wonderful things that we would be without were it not for NEA. Case in point, there was a series on PBS last Monday and tonight on the work of Edward R. Murrow, which is funded in great part by the National Endowment for the Arts, and were it not for their dollars, we wouldn't have this kind of a program for young people who didn't know that time in television and radio to take a look at it.
So I agree with you. I think there is a legitimate point in government funding supporting those projects which could be considered to be beneficial or educational to the public. Yet at the same time, the person who's going to make the blasphemous or avant-garde art should not be prevented from doing so. On the other hand, maybe he shouldn't really look to the government to finance him
while doing it. This is, you know, as Heston said, because it's not financed by government doesn't mean it can't be published or performed.
Yes.
We are not taking away the individual's right to do that. It's just we aren't going to give public dollars to an individual who has as his or her object upsetting the people with their creativity.
Right, he has every right to upset the people,
yeah.
But he doesn't necessarily have the right to have the government pay him to upset the people.
Right. Or, as you say, using public dollars purely to create controversy.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of other places, I suppose, for funding, but it is convenient to come to the government because oftentimes... the review isn't as serious or as harsh as it might be if you were going to, say, a stockholder for his dollars.
Yes, that's true.
And what about movie making in general and filmmaking in general, including the kinds of pictures that Roger Corman makes? What is changing here in this decade? How is the audience for movies changing? It seems to me that movies are becoming more violent. That movies are becoming more spectacular, and that it's awfully difficult to make a picture like Driving Miss Daisy, which was basically a little story about little people. It seems like the big screen needs big events to fuel it and fire it.
It does, but you reach a point of diminishing returns. For instance, this summer, there have been any number of big, high-tech, hardware films that have opened very well, but there have been so many of them out there that now as we get to the midpoint or a little later in the summer, you're beginning to see some of those films start to fade at the box office a little faster than the filmmakers had hoped. As a matter of fact, a great deal faster than the filmmakers had hoped. And a film like Ghost or a number of others, which are, they're not low-budget films, they're expensive films, but they're not such grandiose films, and they're more of a personal story. Or in the spring, Pretty Woman. This type of film starts to generate an audience in reaction to one big slam-bang film after another. So mm-hmm. We may be seeing the peak of that kind of film.
Let me ask you something else. Do you think a lot of people might stay away from the movies knowing it's coming to their video store in 2 months or 3 months or even a shorter period of time? I mean, I was... The other day my daughter brought over to my house to watch was Bambi, and I thought back to when I was a kid, Rog, and we're probably about the same age. I never thought we'd be able to take Bambi home in a box.
Exactly.
But think about it. You can now take almost any movie you want home in a box and watch it as many times as you want for $1 a day or $2 a day.
I think it was early last year that a kind of watershed point was reached, and that was the total income to the motion picture industry from home video was greater than all the theaters combined. I never thought I would live to see that point.
It really is more from home video.
The home video business is bigger than the motion picture theater business today.
You know why?
I think for one thing, it's more convenient and it's also less expensive.
And I'll tell you another reason. Movie theaters ain't no fun no more. They're just boxes with screens. There are no ushers. There are no balconies. You remember movie theaters used to be an event, just the theater itself?
The movie palace.
Yeah. Today, the theater has no personality. The Cineplex, while it has become larger, is still basically a box with a screen and 18 speakers. But it doesn't have any... The theater has no ambiance itself. It's not a pleasant place to go with the lights on, whereas the old theaters were.
Yes, theaters like Grauman's Chinese and the Egyptians were architectural marvels.
Right. And by the way, every city in America had an Egyptian theater. When I was a kid, the theater I went to on Tetonia Avenue in Milwaukee was the Egyptian, and the movie was 12 cents. I mean, every city has an Egyptian, Every city has a Venetian because there are themes that they could use to make them movie palaces.
Yes.
We're talking with Roger Corman, who is the author of How I Made 100 Movies in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. The video cassette, did you think when movies were first out on video cassette, that no, you have already said you didn't think the day would ever come when their income would outpoint that of motion picture theater receipts?
I remember when we made our first video cassette deal, it was with Warner Brothers, and we got something like $20,000 a picture. And I thought, I can't believe this. I thought, these old pictures, and they're actually giving me this money?
Mm-hmm.
And then it grew and grew and grew and grew until it's reached this point.
Everything old is new again. There's a cable channel called Nickelodeon, which is basically a kids' channel, but they run a program called Nick at Night, which has reruns of Saturday Night Live, Donna Reed, Fred McMurray, Bewitched, Fernwood Tonight, those kinds of half-hour strip shows from the 50s and 60s. But they package it very carefully. And they also Hitchcock. They remember the Hitchcocks?
Oh, yes, right.
And it says, insist on original Nick brand reruns. Pretty clever marketing, huh? And the way you're watching old television shows, but they are marketed so beautifully and presented with all this promotional material folded in, that I was up till 2 o'clock this morning watching Nick at Night, believe it.
Great.
Yeah, and I think it's great, by the way. I do think it's great.
Yeah.
And I hope that the original packagers and producers get some money from all this stuff that's running again.
A lot of times
they don't.
But sometimes you're sold out or it's gone to another company and you can't track it down.
Now, in the case of your picture, the Frankenstein picture that's coming out in fall, when you made that picture, I'm sure that a video cassette consideration was a part of the original production license.
That's right. Yes. We shot the picture in Italy last fall on a $9 million budget, and part of the financing, both from the domestic side, the United States and Canada, and the foreign side, was an advance against the video cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
And the advance against the video cassettes was about as big as the advance against the theatrical distribution.
The rentals, right? Now, when you do that, do you, as the producer of the picture, get to say how long after it opens in a theater, how much time must go by before they can release it in video cassette? How is that determination made?
There are certain windows that are written into the contracts now. Generally, the video cassette, the home video, will come out anywhere from a minimum of 90 days, which
mm-hmm.
is pretty fast, up to a maximum of maybe 6-7 months
right.
after the theatrical release. Now, after the video cassette, there's another window, and I've forgotten what it is, but a certain number of months, and then it will go to pay TV,
mm-hmm.
cable TV. Then there's another window, and that's sometimes, I think, up to a year, and then it can go to free TV, to syndicated television.
Now, there's another interesting thing happening in cable and satellite television, and that's called pay-per-view, where they now have two windows. Before, it will play on home box office or Showtime. It'll play on pay-per-view maybe a month before that.
Yes.
And you don't get it as part of your cable service, but you'll pay $3.95 for the picture or $4.95, depending on what service you buy and what cable system you subscribe to. So they're finding all different ways of marketing this in as many different areas as they can before it finally goes to free television. There are a lot of windows for movies these days.
Yes, that's right. The problem with pay-per-view, which potentially might be the biggest of all,
mm-hmm.
is not that many homes are wired for it. So everybody keeps saying this is going to be the thing that will take off, and it is growing, but it's not growing quite as fast as people
hope. However, when they get to this new satellite technology that I'm sure you've read about, direct broadcast service,
yes.
with the smaller dishes. Satellite television now is an addressable service. In other words, I'm a satellite dish owner, and there are some pay-per-view numbers that I can simply dial an 800 number and give them my code number, and they will release the picture to my satellite dish and mine only, and they will send me a bill 30 days down the road for $4.95 or $3.95, depending upon what picture I've ordered. So once satellite technology becomes more widespread, I think then pay-per-view is going to be an enormously a successful source of revenue for you and for the other people making pictures.
Everybody I know is waiting for that day.
As a matter of fact, wouldn't it be something if the day came when there were no such thing as movie theaters? And I hope it doesn't. But look, you know, vaudeville, who would have thought that vaudeville would ever disappear? And who would have thought that Fibber McGee and Molly on the radio would ever disappear? And who would think that movie theaters would ever disappear?
Well, ever since the introduction of television, people have predicted that the motion picture theater would fade, and it may well fade in the distant future. But at least for the moment, people still seem to want to have that group feeling.
Right.
The thing that I'm with other people, I've taken a date or I've gone with friends, and it's an event.
A shared experience, surely. Yes. And by the way, I support that. But you and I know that home technology is becoming more sophisticated every single day. Dolby surround sound is now available in the home. Big screen, high-definition television will soon be available in the home. First-run films on high-definition video cassette and Laserdisc are now available in the home. And as technology improves, who's to say what the viewing choice of the future is going to be?
Well, home video has grown so rapidly, you're beginning to see a whole switch in people's philosophy.
And doesn't your six-year-old have the mermaid at home?
Yes, my six-year-old daughter, Mary, has seen My Little Mermaid at least five times. The X rating. The X was simply to mark a picture that would be for adults and not for children. But what happened, the pornographic filmmakers put X on the front of their films, then they put double X and triple X and multi X, whatever it is. And in the public's mind, X became associated with pornography, and that was not the original intention. So I think the answer could be quite simple, that the MPA could just say, we are no longer going to give an X rating. We will give an A rating for adult or M for mature, and if it's anything beyond that, we won't rate the film. So therefore, the pornographers could stay with their X rating, which they want, and the mature filmmaker who has made a film that's a little bit beyond an R rating could have an acceptable rating of an A or an M and not have anything to worry about.
What's interesting to me is that the explosion in home video that we have been talking about here and that has been talked about on other programs ad nauseum was fueled and begun by the X-rated motion picture. People no longer had to go to the Pussycat Theater. They could rent The Devil and Miss Jones in the privacy of a video store and take it home for the weekend.
Yes.
And the fascination of the classic Frankenstein story. Roger Corman is doing a Frankenstein picture.
Well, I think the classic Frankenstein story is originally written by Mary Shelley. Really combined man's fascination with and slight fear of scientific advance with the concept of the horror picture or horror book, so that it combined science fiction before there was science fiction and horror, and horror taps into the unconscious, into things that go back thousands or millions of years in man's mind. And my picture, Frankenstein Unbound, does a little bit of that. It combines science fiction, horror, and a little bit of a fantasy. It's a very strange film. It starts in the 21st century with a government scientist who's doing military research for the government and for the army. He causes a time slip, and he goes back in time to the 19th century, and he meets Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein.
Right.
And he also meets Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster, and he's found that he's in a weird world where the creator of the novel and the characters in the novel all coexist. And he has a series of adventures there, and then he and the monster travel forward in time 1,000 years into the future.
Right.
So it's a very, very strange film.
It just strikes me that Frankenstein has gone into so many different directions. We have the picture that you have coming out. There were the classic Boris Karloff pictures of the 1930s that are still watched from beneath the covers with all the lights turned off and all the windows closed and the door locked. Then didn't Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein?
Yes, they did.
And didn't Mel Brooks do a wonderful send-off called Young Frankenstein?
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, for that reason, I originally didn't want to do the picture. It started a few years ago when Universal did some market research without telling me, and that was okay.
Right.
And they came up with the conclusion that a picture called Roger Corman's Frankenstein would be successful. And they called me and asked me if I wanted to come back as a director and make it. And I said, as a matter of fact, I really don't, for exactly the reason you've stated. I said, there have been so many Frankenstein pictures, this would be the 90th, and who would care? And they called me occasionally over the next couple of years. And then finally, Tom Mount, who'd been head of production at Universal, left to form his own company, and he called me. And I remembered this novel, written about 10 years ago by Brian Aldiss, Frankenstein Unbound, and I should have remembered it earlier, but it's one of those things that just slips your mind. I thought, that's really an original and new version of the Frankenstein story, and that had a couple of thoughts of my own that I was able to integrate into it, and the net result is I made the film.
By the way, and here's another idea that I'll give you. I was talking with a man one time named Neil Simon, who was talking about losing his first wife and moving to California. This was back in New York. And he had married his second wife, and he was saying, you know, that there are a lot of adjustments. I says, why don't you write a play about that? It was called Chapter 2. Okay?
Right.
I am surprised that no television network has come to you and said, as they did to Hitchcock, do a half-hour anthology every week.
Well, as a matter of fact, one network has approached me.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't so much to do an anthology. They would like to have me do a science fiction series, because there hasn't been anything new since the original Star Trek.
What did the guy in Universal say when he called? He says, we'd like that Roger Corman's version of Frankenstein would be extremely marketable.
Yes.
I think that your take on almost any of the 100 best movies of the last 25 years would be a marketable commodity on network television.
Oh, I think it's a great idea.
By the way, it happens to be a sensational idea. Like, you know how Nick at Night has all the old commercial TV reruns I just mentioned them to you?
Yes.
I'm surprised that no cable channel has taken the best of the wealth of PBS for the last 20 years and repackaged it and run it as a cable television channel to subscribers. There would be to see Masterpiece Theater again.
Yes.
To see upstairs, back downstairs again, to see Riley, Ace of Spies, and Smiley's People, to see all that again, I'd pay $3 a month to see that.
Well, I think with the breaking into more and more channels and more ways to go and more pay TV, I think that could happen.
I like it on Sundays on ABC. What's ABC got on Sunday night? Right up against in Living Color, Roger Corman Presents. I can see it now on Channel 7.
So we'll talk about this.
Yeah, well, yeah. In the next lifetime, I'm going to produce stuff. I really am. Barry in Cleveland, hello.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay, Bear.
I have a question. I love to go to the movies, and for all the reasons that people love to go to the movies, and I love the convenience of video cassettes. One of the things that I'm really angry about is the transference from the film to the cassette, and the aspect ratio, I think is what they call it.
Right.
And it's annoying. I lose so much of the film. Why can't we see more of the video cassettes in that envelope style?
That is beginning to happen. I think you're seeing, and I haven't seen that many recent video cassettes, but it's my understanding that more and more the filmmakers are writing into their contracts clauses that state that the film should be shown in its original manner, because I've seen video cassettes and on television of pictures that I shot long ago in Panavision, and the compositions are completely off. I think I could never have had a shot like that.
And by the way, don't they show the credits with the picture cropped? You know,
yes,
what I'm saying, top
right.
And bottom. And then the minutes the credits are over, they do something that changes the whole aspect ratio, and you lose the peripheral completely.
Yes.
You lose the whole side effect of the picture.
Well, it would seem to me you've gone through great effort to shoot something different than what I get to see, and it's a shame. It's a waste.
I'm in complete agreement with you.
Here is, let me see, Peckett Tom. Jim in Philadelphia. Hello.
Hi, Tom and Roger. I got a question. I'm in the Philadelphia metropolitan area. We have 5 million people. We have 2 drive-in theaters. There's maybe ones on the outskirts, north, kind of the outskirts of the metropolitan area.
It's up in the great northeast, isn't it?
Yeah, is there, maybe in Southern California, you can have them open there more year-round, but I'm sure the land is getting so valuable, they may go the way of the dinosaur. What's your thoughts on the future of the drive-in theater?
I think you're right.
That is right. I think they are going the way of the dinosaur. There are fewer and fewer drive-ins every year. The ones where they hang in the most, as you say, are generally in the southern states where they can stay open all year round. But really, I think in a few years they're going to be all gone. It was a wonderful period. I like going to the drive-ins.
We all did.
I liked playing films there, but I fear it's gone.
They had playgrounds for the kids and everything, and the cartoons they would run, the animated hot dogs and stuff dancing.
That's right.
And Roger, give yourself credit, too, for all the famous people you've made in the business. You've opened a lot of doors to a lot of people out there.
Well, I hope there'll still be a few more coming along.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Okay. Here's Ken now in West Hampton, New York. Hello.
How are you doing tonight?
Okay.
Good. I wanted to say the young lady that answers the phone is absolutely one of the nicest people you could ask for, so just wanted to give a little credit there.
Appreciate that. And by the way, you happen to be correct. Thank you.
Well, I think I am, too. Roger, I was just wondering, years ago when they had the studio system, you know, the actors got to act with different directors, and they learned as they went. It was kind of a nice training ground for people. It doesn't seem to be anything like that around today because you got the big stars with the high bucks, and there's really no depth, I guess, in the training and the learning process, at least from that aspect. Where does someone like yourself or someone who would want to move about in the thing or get started, would they start and kind of get their feet wet and learn the ropes and, apprentice or whatever you want to call it?
Well, for filmmakers, that is for writers, producers, directors, cameramen, and so forth, the film schools have emerged at the major universities probably within the last 20 years or so. And I think they give an extremely good training, in some respects better than apprenticing at the studios the way it was done in the past. For the actors, it's a little bit more difficult because the B-picture units of the major studios that gave training to young actors no longer exist. You might say television fulfills a portion of that, but it's a little bit more difficult.
As a matter of fact, the end of the double bill really changed the business forevermore, didn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because at that time they had 2 pictures for the price of 1.
That's right, but the other picture was a place for all the young actors to fall on their face and it was okay.
Yes, right.
We are talking with Roger Corman. You're always a fast hour, my friend. I can't wait for your night on Oscar night, I'll tell you. And when you're ready with Frankenstein Unbound, you'll come back, we'll chat some more, okay?
Very good.
Mr. Roger Corman, his book is called How I Made 100 Pictures in Hollywood and Never Lost a Dime. This is the Monday Night Radio Show. Thanks for listening, everybody.